It was shaping up as a beautiful morning. The last thing I wanted to hear about was murder. A cool Pacific current had swept its way across the coastline for 2 days running, propelling the pollution to Pasadena. My house is nestled in the foothills just north of Bel Air, situated atop an old bridle path that snakes its way around Beverly Glen, where opulence gives way to self-conscious funk. It's a neighborhood of Porsches and coyotes, bad sewers and sequestered streams. The place itself is 1,800 square feet of silvered redwood, weathered shingles, and tinted glass. In the suburbs, it might be a shack. Up here in the hills, it's a rural retreat. Nothing fancy, but lots of terraces, decks, pleasing angles, and visual surprises. The house had been designed by and for a Hungarian artist who went broke trying to peddle oversized polychromatic triangles to the galleries on La Cienega. Art's loss had been my gain by way of L.A. probate court. On a good day, like today, the place came with an ocean view, a cerulean patch that peaked timidly above the Palisades. I had slept alone with the windows open, burglars and neo-Mansonites be damned, and awoke at 10, naked, covers thrown to the floor in the midst of some forgotten dream. Feeling lazy and sated, I propped myself on my elbows, drew up the covers, and stared at the caramel layers of sunlight streaming through French doors. What finally got me up was the invasion of a housefly who alternated between searching my sheets for carrion and dive-bombing my head. I shuffled to the bathroom and began filling a tub, then made my way to the kitchen to scavenge, taking the fly with me. I put up coffee, and the fly and I shared an onion bagel. 10:20 on a Monday morning with nowhere to go and nothing to do. Oh, blessed decadence. It had been almost half a year since my premature retirement, and I was still amazed at how easy it was to make the transition from compulsive overachiever to self-indulgent bum. Obviously, I'd had it in me from the beginning. I returned to the bathroom, sat on the rim of the tub, munching, and drew up a vague plan for the day. A leisurely soak, a cursory scan of the morning paper, perhaps a jog down the canyon and back, a shower, a visit to... The doorbell jarred me out of my reverie. I tied a towel around my waist and walked to the front entry in time to see Milo let himself in. "It was unlocked," he said, closing the door hard and tossing the Times on the sofa. He stared at me, and I drew the towel tighter. "Good morning, nature boy." I motioned him in. "You really should lock the door, my friend. I've got files at the station that illustrate nicely what happens to people who don't." "Good morning, Milo." I padded into the kitchen and poured two cups of coffee. Milo followed me like a lumbering shadow, opened the refrigerator, and took out a plate of cold pizza that I had no recollection of ever owning. He tailed me back to the living room, collapsed on my old leather sofa, an artifact of the abandoned office on Wilshire, balanced the plate on his thigh, and stretched out his legs. I turned off the bathwater and settled opposite him on a camelskin ottoman. Milo is a big man, 6'2", 220, with a big man's way of going loose and dangly when he gets off his feet. This morning he looked like an oversized rag doll slumped against the cushions, a doll with a broad, pleasant face, almost boyish except for the acne pits that peppered the skin and the tired eyes. The eyes were startlingly green and rimmed with red, topped by shaggy dark brows and a Kennedy-esque shock of thick black hair. His nose was large and high-bridged, his lips full, childishly soft. Sideburns 5 years out of date trailed down the scarred cheeks. As usual, he wore ersatz Brooks Brothers, olive-green gabardine suit, yellow button-down, mint and gold rep-striped tie, oxblood wingtips. The total effect was as preppy as W.C. Fields in red skivvies. He ignored me and concentrated on the pizza.